Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. How are you?
Today on Mountain Money, we're going to start by speaking with author George Selgin. He'll be talking about his new book, False Dawn, The New Deal and the Promise of Recovery, 1933 to 1947.
Next, we'll try to get an idea of when Offset Beer will be moving to the new location. Also, what does it take to move a brewery? With Connor Brown, one of Offset Beer's founders. Then we're joined by Roger Gindelsberger Jr., CEO of Grind, the toothpaste company, and Mark Espinoza from Walmart about how Walmart's open call helped Grind scale up substantially. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
The conventional wisdom about the Great Depression is that Herbert Hoover did a little to address the downturn, and that Franklin Roosevelt's bold New Deal programs put the country on a road to recovery that culminated with the commencement of World War II. While the New Deal's goals were explicitly relief, recovery, and reform, there's some real questions as to the extent to which the New Deal experiments actually promoted recovery. Author George Selgin takes on these questions in his new book, False Dawn, The New Deal and the Promise of Recovery. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me on your show. I see I'm competing with a segment about beer. This is going to be tough.
Well, I suspect that somewhere time during the Great Depression, I think we got rid of Prohibition, so maybe it all works together.
So, there is indeed a link. I have there's a very good book by a fellow named Jason Taylor, who used to be a student of mine, about the beginnings of repeal of Prohibition and how they contributed to recovery. So there is indeed a link between the subjects.
So tell us about, you know, what motivated you to write this book. It's quite a work of scholarship. What motivated you to write it, and how long did it take you to pull all this research together?
The motivation mainly consisted of seeing lots of very superficial claims made about the New Deal and recovery. Basically, you had these two extreme views, one of which says, oh, the New Deal ended the Depression, which is risible, because in 1939, when the New Deal was over, effectively, there were still a large number of people unemployed and on work relief, more than was the case in any of our more recent crises. On the other hand, you have people saying, well, World War II ended it because the government was spending all this money. And that's not satisfactory either, because wartime government spending, military spending, and total government spending declined dramatically after the war, and yet the Depression didn't recur, as a lot of people thought it might. So I thought there was room for a book that talked just about the recovery, how we achieved it, and what role the New Deal played. And so that's why I wrote it. It took me about, I'd say all told about 4 years, because I started with a bunch of essays that were my preliminary shots at getting the story right. Then I collected feedback and put them together with some new material into the book. So altogether about 4 or 5 years.
No, it's a good time. So now, can you set the stage a bit with respect to the economic landscape faced by FDR when he won the 32 election?
I can. Of course, the U.S. had been in a very deep depression by then for several years. And it was widely believed that, or understood, I should say, because it's true, that Hoover's policies simply weren't succeeding in getting the economy out. So Roosevelt inherited a very deep depression. Should be said, though, that it got deeper before he actually took office. What a lot of people may not remember is that the 1932 election was the last one in which the actual date on which Roosevelt would take office, that is the date of the inauguration, was not until early March. So you had a long period between the election and Roosevelt actually assuming power. And during that time, things just got worse and worse, culminating in the national bank crisis in 1933. So bad as things were when Roosevelt took office, or rather when he was elected, they were even worse, considerably worse, when he actually assumed power. And then, of course, he had a whole new emergency he had to deal with that couldn't be anticipated, couldn't have been anticipated back in November 1932.
And before we get to the bank crisis, which is pretty important, just share a little bit more about the scope of the economic disruption. What are sort of the big macro measures that we can look at in terms of things like GDP or unemployment that to help us understand just how big a deal this was?
Sure. Well, the main statistics are indeed real GDP, real output, prices, the price level, and employment and unemployment. And things were very bad, particularly, as I said, by March 1933, on all those scores. Overall, the economy lost about a third of its nominal output between 1929 and 1933. And a big part of that, though some of that was deflation, much of it was real output that collapsed. So this is a very, very substantial decline. It's still by far the deepest decline in economic activity that the U.S. has ever experienced. The unemployment statistics were likewise, expectedly, very bad because, of course, if you're producing less, you're hiring fewer workers to do the producing. And in March 1933, the combined percentage of the workforce that was either outright unemployed, completely out of luck, or employed in emergency programs, it's important to note the difference here, was as high as 25%. And most of that was outright unemployment. Over time, the amount of workers in work relief grew under the Roosevelt administration's New Deal. Still, by the end of the 1930s, by 1939, the figure of those combined components of what's often misleadingly called the unemployment rate, the figure for the total either outright unemployed or in work relief was still over 17%. At the worst peaks of the most recent economic downturns, let's just say, look at COVID, we were talking about unemployment in the low double digits. Mm-hmm. So the Great Depression is longer and worse than anything we've seen since. And indeed, as far as available statistics show, it was longer and worse than anything before.
Okay, so let's go back to the banking crisis. What was the magnitude of the banking crisis in the early 30s, and what caused it?
Well, the magnitude was such that many thousands of banks failed, and in just the space of several years. And there was a very large proportion of all banks, even allowing that the U.S. had about 30,000 banks going into the crisis, which is an exceptionally large number, as you can imagine. A lot of those were very small banks. At first, the banking crisis was mostly concentrated in the countryside, and its roots went back to World War I, actually, because of the war and because the U.S. government encouraged it, there was tremendous overinvestment in farming. A lot of new farms or a lot of new acreage got planted. And after the war, a lot of these farms became unprofitable as European crop production revived. So it was the case, not only that we had a lot of bank failures in the 30s, but that we were having thousands of banks fail every year, even in the 1920s. So the rot in the banking system has been going on for about a decade when the Great Depression breaks out. But it gets worse because, of course, as the general economic situation deteriorates, that many more banks that were by then hanging on by a thread are now vulnerable and start failing. So you have an acceleration in the number of failures. Then as the Depression continues, the nature of the banking troubles starts to change. You get more and more trouble in larger city banks, and not just rural banks involved with lending to farmers. And two other factors start to kick in that culminate in this major banking meltdown just before Roosevelt takes office. First, some governors started passing bank holidays, closing their banks in anticipation of problems, and that triggered panics in the neighboring states, where other bankers especially would say, oh, we better get our deposits out of our correspondents in those states. That created more waves of bank failures. And the last factor, which is very important, is that is one of the big things that happens between Roosevelt's election and the inauguration, is that people become more and more concerned about the possibility that Roosevelt will devalue the dollar. And Roosevelt did not want to commit himself to not doing so, quite rightly, in the sense that he had no idea what would be going on in 1933. Unfortunately, that lack of a promise, true or false, to not devalue, got more and more people thinking that the dollar would be devalued. They started a run on gold in February 33. And that meant, if you think the dollar's going to be devalued, that means you take your money out of the bank, and then you run on the Federal Reserve with your Federal Reserve dollars and say, hey, I want my gold. And that's what was happening in February, March 1933. Until the Fed itself, Fed officials themselves in New York especially, they pleaded for the government to close the banks, starting with New York State. And that's what eventually happened. As soon as Roosevelt took office, he shut down all the banks. So these were all the aspects of a very involved banking crisis. But it's important to realize that while the crisis was made as severe as it was by the Depression, it in turn made the Depression more severe. So you have a double feedback going on.
So what was the New Deal response to the banking crisis?
That's a tricky question to answer, because in fact, there was, of course, a concerted response by the Roosevelt administration to the crisis, consisting first of declaring the banks closed throughout the country, which is what I was just describing, and then of announcing a plan in Roosevelt's first fireside chat about how the government planned eventually to reopen all the sound banks. And this plan was to reassure people that once banks were reopened, they could trust them and keep their money there. Now, here's what makes the answer tricky, is that that plan was actually concocted by Hoover administration treasury people. They stayed on board, indeed, to help implement it. So on the one hand, it was a New Deal undertaking. But in a more fundamental sense, it was the Hoover administration's swan song. They worked together with the FDR team to resolve the banking crisis. And they did it very successfully. So I don't wish to deny credit to either part of that team, that blend of Roosevelt people and Hoover Treasury people. They all contributed. Roosevelt himself, of course, contributed, because that fireside chat was a very impressive piece of rhetoric that many believe helped to calm people and make the reopening of the banks successful.
Now, how important, a lot of times when people think of New Deal policies, one of the ones they think about is the advent of federal deposit insurance. How important was that?
I am not able to hear you.
You can't hear us?
Or is that, I can hear you, but I couldn't hear
Yes. The question I was asking was about FDIC. How important, people think of that as a big New Deal policy that was instrumental in changing things. Yeah. How important was it in terms of resolving the banking crisis?
Well, that's another tricky question, because Roosevelt, of course, signed off on the FDIC. which insures banks to this day, and that insurance took effect in January 1934 with some preliminary temporary insurance just before it. But Roosevelt himself was never a fan of deposit insurance, so he actually fought that component of the Banking Act of 1933 pretty much till the 11th hour, at the very last minute, realizing that Congress was likely to override any attempt to veto the bill, and also not wanting to shoot down other aspects of that banking legislation, Roosevelt signed off. But he had been a steadfast critic of deposit insurance. Interestingly, Hoover had also been a critic. They shared a lot of views in common, Hoover and Roosevelt, despite the impression that we gained from posterity. But Hoover actually changed his mind at the last minute. He was trying to nudge the government, the Fed in particular, into accepting deposit insurance. Anyway, as for what deposit insurance did, I think its effects are overrated. It was certainly one of several factors that helped rebuild people's confidence in the banking system. Of course, if you can't lose money, you're less likely to run on your bank. So those people who are fully insured, at least, did lose the incentive. But we have to also remember that as well as adopting deposit insurance, and before doing so, the government prohibited gold ownership and made it required all those who had withdrawn gold to put their gold back in the system. Since one of the major reasons why people ran on the banks, especially in February and March 1933, was to get gold, and now they couldn't have it, that itself, of course, was one of the factors that made runs on banks less likely, that shouldn't be overlooked. Finally, there's a fact that is even more easy to overlook, which is simply that there were a lot of banks, even as late as March 1933, that were actually not considered unsound. People may have run on them to get gold, but they didn't doubt that the banks are sound. For example, all the New York banks, the big New York banks, they were perfectly solvent. And indeed, they didn't want the government shutting them down in 33, but the New York Fed wanted it to shut the banks down because it was running out of gold. So it's important to realize that a lot of the banks that were successfully reopened, in the sense that nobody started runs on them after they were reopened, were banks that people had no reason to run on because they didn't think all banks were insolvent to begin with. And so that's why, by the way, the bank inspectors who were, according to Roosevelt's fireside chat, bank inspectors were going to look through all the books and decide which banks were solvent or not and only open the solvent ones. Well, there was a lot of hocus pocus in that because they didn't have time. They couldn't possibly do it. What they could do was open banks that they knew perfectly well were sound without even having to do much research. But they weren't the only ones who knew they were sound. So those banks could be opened safely without deposit insurance. You had to make sure that people couldn't take out gold, but you didn't need deposit insurance because you didn't have any real distrust of those banks. And there were not a small number of banks. Deposit insurance helped, but its role is exaggerated.
Another sort of program that we learned about in high school that was so important was how many people Roosevelt put to work with shovels. Talk to us a little bit about the NRA and what effect you believe it had on wages and employment.
Okay, so there's two pieces of legislation involved in the so-called National Industrial Recovery Act. That's the name of the legislation that included the NRA, which is the National Recovery Administration, and also included a big relief program. And so we have to make sure not to mix those two things up. There was a big work relief program as part of the 33 Act, and that put a lot of people to work in emergency jobs. And that's, you know, that's fine. That was a way to make sure that people had some source of income, and also to keep them employed in the sense of having productive things to do. And they weren't all leaning on shovels or that sort of thing. They were working. So those are the people who it's misleading to say we're unemployed. On the other hand, it's also misleading to not count them as a part of the problem, in the sense that you wouldn't have needed so many people on relief if the economy really had recovered. And by the way, Roosevelt was very clear on this, as were other New Dealers. They said, look, these are emergency jobs, but the ultimate task of recovery is to get people into non-emergency jobs. So they too would not have gauged the progress of recovery by counting everybody on work relief as being fully employed, you know, in the natural sense, in the sense that economists mean. What they wanted was to have people ultimately get real jobs in place of these emergency jobs, jobs in the factories and mines and other places that had been shut down by the Depression. Okay, so that's the work relief part of the 1933 Act. The NRA didn't create work relief. It tried to help foster recovery by creating a bunch of industrial codes, or letting various industries create those codes, where the codes were supposed to dictate what prices firms and industries could charge, what wage rates they had to pay or could pay. And the whole idea was to limit output and boost wage rates, with the belief, based on the belief, that the higher prices went and the higher wage rates were, the better off the economy would be, because firms would be earning more and workers would be earning more and spending more, and that would help recover. It was a very dumb theory. I don't know how to put it otherwise. Of course, you wanted wage rates and prices to go up. You wanted people to be spending more. But you couldn't boost spending just by restricting output or by mandating certain wage rates. Firms only had so much revenue. And if you told them they had to pay higher wage rates, in practice, what that meant, if you didn't do anything else to stimulate spending, it meant that they could only hire fewer workers. And if it hadn't been for other rules that shared, where work sharing rules, the unemployment rate would actually have gone up. The only reason it didn't go up even further as a result of the NRA was work sharing. So you had jobs that were divvied up among larger numbers of workers, but they became part-time jobs. So the NRA was a, most economists agree, there's one notable exception I talk about in my book, most economists agree that the NRA as a recovery device was a disaster. And even the New Dealers, by 1935, when the Supreme Court struck the whole thing down as unconstitutional, most New Dealers, Roosevelt was a prominent exception, were glad to see it go, because they realized it was not turning out the way they wanted it to.
From a recovery perspective, as there are other programs that you touch on in great detail in the book, from a recovery perspective, as opposed to the other goals of the New Deal, what lessons from your analysis should policymakers draw when confronting future economic development, economic downturns? What worked?
So, I'm glad you distinguish between recovery and other goals of the New Deal, because that's very important. The New Deal was a program of recovery, reform, and relief. We can give it high marks on recovery and reform, where reform is long-term reforms, without necessarily believing that it was a good set of programs for promoting recovery. We can learn some things. There are negative and positive lessons. We can learn that something like the NRA should never be tried again, as far as combating depression is concerned. But there were also positive things. We talked about deposit insurance, and that was, you know, the smaller contribution, but I think the most important recovery programs in the New Deal were the ones that had the government taking over mortgages or refinancing, both residential and farm mortgages. And the reason why that was those programs were important and I think very helpful is that when you have a collapse in spending, ideally, in economic theory, if you let prices all fall in general, it's like starting over and getting back to equilibrium. Except some things can't, prices and contracts can't easily be renegotiated to reflect the reality of a much less substantial amount of spending. And that was the case with mortgages. Very hard to renegotiate. These government programs did it. They were very cleverly designed. And in the end, especially the residential program, saved both a lot of homeowners a great deal of grief and spared a lot of their creditors who were, you know, all they were going to get out of these their mortgages was at best foreclosing on a lot of property that they then couldn't dispose of except at a loss. So by renegotiating, the government played a role that took a part in the mortgage business that wasn't going to be taken by anyone else. They did rely on implicit subsidies because taxpayers were guaranteeing all of these new mortgages. And that was a risky gambit. But as it happens, in the long run, it seems to have paid off pretty well, partly because real estate prices eventually recovered, which meant that the government, which itself ended up foreclosing on a lot of property, because even at the better rates, people defaulted, didn't end up taking any big losses. So those are two programs I think deserve special mention in the plus side of the New Deal recovery efforts.
Okay, the book is False Dawn, The New Deal and the Promise of Recovery. We've been speaking with author George Sagan. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back after this.
It's a very low-key, tucked-away location behind Good Earth. At this time of year, you can find it by the large open garage door and maybe a few bicycles outside. I'm talking about Offset Beer's brewery and tasting room, but they're moving. Sometime in the not-so-distant future, over by Proverbial Spirits on Forestdale. So we can hear what it takes to move a brewery, we are joined by Connor Brown. Good morning, Connor, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, how long have you been at your present location?
We opened the doors on September 10th of 2021.
Okay. And how many customers can you fit inside?
We have about 32 seats. Okay. In there. I think our legal capacity is technically 49 people.
Okay.
Yep.
And have you outgrown that space?
Yeah, we have. I mean, we more so from a production standpoint. We need to be able to produce a little bit more beer. And yeah, to kind of be a little bit better, more functioning business, I would say. So really, that, you know, the impetus for the move, I mean, I would love to stay where we are in some way, shape, or form. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen. But yeah, a lot of it has to do with being able to produce a little bit more beer to A, meet the demand, but to be a, you know, a little bit more better functioning business overall.
Now, in the existing space, you obviously have some room for people. Mm-hmm. You have some room for equipment. How much? Can you describe how much equipment and what kinds of equipment it takes to produce the beer?
I could talk about it for a long time. I'm trying to summarize it as much as possible. But yeah, we have what's called a brew house, which is essentially the hot side of the process, which is where you kind of mash the grains and boil the wort, and then that goes into different fermenters where the beer is fermented. And then, yeah, we essentially will keg or can off of the fermenters, and we have a small little canning line that we roll back there. It's a very small space that we actually manufacture the beer in. It's incredibly small. I've got plenty of scars on my back to prove that the running into things all day long when there's just not enough room back there. So it's really nice to, you know, look forward to having a little bit more room and being able to have some larger tanks and a larger system, because really we're, in order to make the amount of beer that we're even making now, it's pretty laborious. It's a really long day. It's just a very kind of small system that we've essentially tried to figure out how to get the maximum amount out of it that we possibly can.
Just give our listeners a picture. We talk about it's a laborious and hard process. How long does it take? If we follow a can of beer backwards, right, to the start,
yep.
What would come in the door and what would you do to it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a, you know, a single brew takes about 8 hours, okay. Essentially. We're double brewing essentially to fill. So basically our fermenter volume is double what we can make in 8 hours. So we have to brew twice to fill the fermenters. But yeah, it's, you know, milling grains, mashing, boiling, and whirlpooling, and then knocking it out into the fermenter and adding yeast. But I would say our average, it takes about 14 days.
14 days.
Essentially, okay. to you know, some are quite a bit longer. Traditional lager beer is a little bit more like 2 months. So yeah, it just varies kind of depending on beer style. So.
Okay, so 14 days. I've made beer myself. It took me a lot longer than that.
It probably wasn't as good.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I mean, some beers we can make in as little as 9 days. Mm-hmm. Honestly, it just depends on the yeast, the fermentation, what we're doing to them. Yeah, so, but yeah, I would say 14 is sort of what we target for a fair amount of what we make.
Gotcha.
Yep.
So I know KPCW, we covered the move back in a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And how's that coming?
It's coming. We've actually had some great progress over the last few weeks. Pouring the concrete, and then this week we're actually coating the floors. So in brewing, you use a lot of pretty intense chemicals to do a lot of cleaning and make sure everything is sanitary and sterile as much as we can. And so the flooring actually really needs to be able to hold up to all that stuff that gets spilled on it. And beer is acidic as well. So yeah, we're having the floors coated this week. And then as soon as we get that done, then it's we'll be able to move quite a bit faster and get a lot of stuff actually all set up.
How long will it end up being out of production as a result of having to move all that equipment?
So we actually, so we have almost all new equipment in the new space.
Oh, okay.
Not all. We will use a fair amount of the tanks that we have now, but we have additional tanks, additional brew house. just to be able to be a little bit bigger, we need to, you know, have some larger stuff. So hopefully it's going to be a massive juggling event for sure. But yeah, hopefully no downtime is the goal.
Oh, good.
And we've talked about the facility being bigger. Can you talk a little bit about both the increase in size in terms of production volume, mm-hmm. and in terms of customer seating?
Actually, customer seating probably actually won't be
about
that.
The same.
It'll be about the same. There'll maybe be a little bit more room for people to spread out. You know, the area for our production will go, will probably triple essentially, and the amount that we. The amount that we have the ability to make in the space is probably 4 to 5 times what we make now. I don't really have exactly. I think that's always been my biggest goal is I really want to have beer kind of pulled into the market and not mm-hmm. pushed into the market. So if we don't have the demand yet, and you know, trying to kind of be very slow and methodical with it, take as much time as we can, make sure that we're not overproducing and have any really excess. Inventory in the market.
Yeah, so how many customers can you fit in the new place?
I don't have the legal capacity yet.
Okay.
But it'll be probably a little bit more than what we have now. I think the square footage is probably slightly larger. but really try and, I think create a little bit more. We're kind of cramped at the moment, to say the least.
Yeah.
So have maybe not that much more in the way of seating, but have more room for people to spread out.
Good.
Can you talk a little bit about where your demand comes from? What are your channels of distribution, and how do you sort of encourage a greater consumption?
we don't really have a lot of channels of distribution. I mean, my goal always has been to try and keep the beer as fresh as possible. As a small brand, especially, like, try and keep as much control of the final product as possible. I think that's one thing people oftentimes don't understand about beer. Beer is incredibly fragile. It's not like liquor. It's not like wine. It can't just sit on a shelf. It especially can't sit on a shelf warm, or should not sit on a shelf warm. And so we really try and just maintain as much control as we possibly can. So, plenty of places around town, restaurants. There's only one store that you can buy it at. It's the market right here in town. You can buy one of our products at. Deer Valley is a great customer of ours. You know, in the wintertime, every draft location at all the summer concert series, we're very fortunate for that. So, most of your kind of favorite spots around town, hopefully, to drink beer. And then we sell, for a business or for a brewery of our size, the reason we can even really exist is really trying to sell as much as we can direct to consumer.
Direct.
Yep, exactly. So that's where the margin is. So that's what we try and do as much as we can, and that's where most of our sales come from.
And but that's cans and growlers.
Cans, growlers, and then draft beer, on-premise draft beers. Yeah.
But in terms of trying to drive demand to mm-hmm. with this new facility, mm-hmm. what are you thinking strategically? I mean, are you going to try to get more to the Salt Lake market? How are you going to? Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's an interesting push and pull, right?
It very much is, for sure. I think not a ton more in Salt Lake. Okay. To be honest, I really want to keep as much of the product that we make in Summit County as humanly possible. There's definitely a lot of accounts here in town that we've never even had the ability to approach just because we don't have the ability to meet the demand. So there's definitely going to be a lot of knocking on doors over the next few months to make sure that when we do open up that we do have some more accounts. And then, our demand, I think our demand for on-premise consumption and, to-go beer from our facility has grown quite a bit and continues to grow. And we're having a hard time, meeting demand of the accounts that we have, but also creating enough, special one-off beers. We're releasing a new beer every week, sometimes two a week, which is really what kind of keeps people coming and keeps people walking in the door.
Yeah, so. I love that you don't have to take any downtime, because you did win a gold medal at the Great American Beer Festival.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. We've had a bunch of great accolades over the last year, which is amazing. Yeah, Great American Beer Festival in 2024. Session IPA Divi, or we call them a LIPA Divi, won gold for Session IPA. So, best Session IPA in the country, essentially. So,
agreed.
And it actually, we're canning it next week. It comes back next week. We've won a bunch of, really great kind of awards and got some great national, almost international acclaim over the last, 10 months. So, which has kind of always been the goal. The goal was, first and foremost, to lead with product, try and make world-class beer, make the best beer we possibly can. And so, it's like that a lot of those things are really starting to kind of come to fruition.
Connor, as we get near the end, let's help our listeners understand exactly where the location is. How would you describe Forest?
Location?
I always think of it as Home Depot, but anyway.
Yeah, no, people say Home Depot, and I say, no, not quite that far. I think it's technically called the Park City Business Park. So if you are going out Kearns to 40, and instead of getting on 40 at Quinn's Junction, you just go under 40 and take your first left, and then drive out there a quarter of a mile, and it's on your right-hand side.
So sort of near maybe the gun club
and
the sprinkler stores for those of us who have to deal with sprinklers.
Yes, we're actually right next to the sprinkler store. Yep.
So I could pick up my sprinkler
surprise
and get a beer.
A couple lots down from the gun club, across from Park City Fit.
And just down that road you turn on, Forestdale, is right at the new Burt Brothers.
Right. Yep.
Okay, and will you be offering do you have food or anything else that the customers can have when they come in?
Not really. We have snacks. We're actually working on another location as well, so there's a chance that we might be actually opening two new spots in November.
Holy cow. You're going to be a busy man.
Yes, a busy man as well, for sure. So we're working on potentially trying to keep a footprint in town somewhere and actually having some food at that location. So
awesome. Yeah. We just spent a few minutes with Connor Brown from Offset Beer. Connor, thank you very much. Do you have a website?
Yeah, Offset Beer, but beer with an I. So
beer with an
offset,
I.
BIER.com. Yep.
Awesome. Hey, thank you very much, and we'll be right back. Okay, you have a great product. The manufacturing is running smoothly. The packaging looks great. Now, how are you going to get your product into as many stores as possible? You may want to try Walmart's Open Call. That's what our next guest, Roger Gindelsberger Jr., did, and now his toothpaste, Grind, is in 650 Walmart stores. And along with Roger is Mark Espinoza, Senior Director of Public Affairs for Walmart. Good morning, gentlemen, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Awesome. So there's a lot of choices when it comes to toothpaste, right? You go to Walmart, and Mark, maybe you know how many, you don't know how many toothpaste, but what made you decide you wanted to create a new toothpaste?
Well, the decision was easy. Looking at most of the toothpaste on the shelf, you really have two choices. You either have fluoride, which comes with a warning label on the back, or you have fluoride-free, which comes with essentially nothing to replace it. So the challenge for us was to come out of the gate swinging with a product that did essentially what fluoride does without the use of fluoride. So we came up with a patent-pending, unique combination of natural fluoride alternatives.
Okay, so what does fluoride do, and what are we being warned about?
Yeah, so fluoride does what it's supposed to do. It strengthens and remineralizes your enamel and protects it from cavities. The problem with it is with the controversy behind it is that there's concerns about fluoride toxicity, specifically with children ingesting too much, accidentally, of course. So that said, there are natural ingredients out there that do the same thing. For example, hydroxyapatite's been used in Japan for the last 40 years. It's their gold standard in lieu of fluoride. So you look at the market there, and you have a split between fluoride and hydroxyapatite versus your typical fluoride-free that you see on the shelves here in the U.S.
Yeah, and I'm going to jump to the side real quick. Thank you for your service. Roger is a retired U.S. Army Special Ops. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
So now, how did you hear about Walmart's open call?
Yeah, so right out of the gate, we knew we wanted to eventually, the long-term goal was to partner with Walmart. So I seen it through an organization called Range Me. They come out every year with opportunities to pitch to major retail. And looking at that, we seen open call, and I applied, I think it was in 2020, before I even had my first production run that early. Obviously, we didn't get chosen for 2020, and 2021, we barely had any, we just got up and going. So I applied again in 2022, and that's when we got the opportunity to pitch.
Was it an easy application?
It was a lengthy application. I would say there's some optional components to it, like the video, and I'd recommend that anybody applying definitely do the video.
Okay.
It will help go a long way.
So, Mark, tell us a bit more about the scope of the program and what Walmart's intent is in promoting it.
So we have a $350 billion commitment to purchase products made, grown, or assembled here in the U.S., and it's exciting to find entrepreneurs with products that our customers want and desire. And so Open Call is our annual event where U.S.-based small businesses can pitch their products that are made, grown, or assembled in the U.S. directly to Walmart and Sam's Club buyers. And the reward is they get a shot at getting on Walmart shelves or scaling up fast.
Yeah, so Roger started at how many stores?
365.
And now over 650.
650.
So I'm having a vision of something somewhere between American Idol and Do You Want to Be a Millionaire in terms of, can you talk a little bit more about how the competition actually works?
So every year we open up our application period. So right now it's open until July 25th, and we get thousands of applications like Rogers. And then we go through the vetting process where they get an opportunity to we vet all the applications that come in, and a select few get an opportunity to come to Bentonville, Arkansas, to pitch their products. They get a 30-minute meeting directly with a Walmart or Sam's Club merchant, and they get feedback directly there. These last 2 years, though, we've taken it on the road. Over the last few months, we've been to 8 different locations across the country where we provided entrepreneurs an opportunity to pitch, get their feedback, but then also possibly get a blue pass where they get to go, to your point, to Bentonville, Arkansas, and get hopefully their golden ticket like Roger did.
That's incredible.
And do you have people who, come and you go, you know what, you're close, but this isn't quite going to work, and here's what we suggest you do, and where they get to come back and try again?
Yeah, Roger had a good example of that one where he wasn't at scale yet the first time he applied and ready to go. We've had a few of them that come back and say, you know what, just work on some of these packaging or some of your distribution side of things, and then you'll be ready. One of the key things that we tell folks to do is get on Walmart Marketplace. So apply for Walmart Marketplace and Walmart.com and just get your product out there so we can see what the customers like and where they like it. So when you come back next year and pitch again, we know what the customers are already talking about your product, and that's Walmart Marketplace.
So you can see all the reviews because they're purchasing, let's say, Roger's product before it was in the stores, but it's on the Marketplace online.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Because I do see a lot of things that are online at Walmart, but I can't pick it up in the store. So that's what that is.
So Roger, let's go back to the process. On this show, we love talking to entrepreneurs about how they get from concept to shelf. So you have this idea. How do you go about, you know, do you have a scientific background? How do you go about, you know, creating this patented process? And how do you go about testing it to make sure it actually protects the enamel?
Yeah, it was a lot of trial and error. I do not have a background in oral care whatsoever. My background's in Army Special Operations, specifically logistics. But that said, I partnered with a company here in Utah that does it for a living. So got in the lab and did a lot of research and putting stuff together and finding out what works, what doesn't. We did 7 revisions before we ever launched the product. So we knew we had, you know, we knew what we had in the tube when we launched it, that it was going to be something special.
Yeah. And do you have different flavors?
No. Currently, we only have 1 SKU, 1 product today. Okay. But we have, in the lab, we've built out 2 additional SKUs, and we look forward to bringing those to market very soon.
And where do you do your manufacturing?
We do it in Vineyard, Utah.
Okay, so you truly are a local Utah company.
We are, correct.
And again, as you look toward sort of expanding, you know, your goal is to have sort of multiple flavors on the shelves?
Yes, okay, for sure.
So, Mark, you said thousands of applications. Are we talking 2,000? Are we talking 20,000?
We receive anywhere from between 8,000 and 12,000 applications for individual products a year.
And when did open call application process open?
This year it opened up on June 24th and goes all the way to July 25th.
Okay, so they have 1 month, and you, what percentage already have a product in marketplace?
We're seeing more and more entrepreneurs be very smart and get their products on marketplace first before they even apply. They've learned. This is our 12th one, so it's exciting to see how folks are kind of already getting the idea of what to do before they get there.
So 12 years of this.
Yeah, I was going to say, 12 years. Mark, are there any products that we might have heard of that sort of came in through this door and have become sort of household names?
There's one that comes through all the time is Dude Wipes. They came through Open Call. And they're now in all of our stores and growing even more with new products. This last month, they launched Bubble Bum, Dude Wipes, Little Wipes for kids as well. Another one that's actually right there in Salt Lake City manufacturing is Smash Kitchen, Smash Sunflower Seeds. They just came through last year's open call and got a golden ticket, and they manufacture right there in Salt Lake City.
So I get the golden ticket. I see that Roger here is in some, 650 stores. Is there a process by which, if that's successful, they'll allow him to expand into more stores? How does that work?
So one of the things we tell entrepreneurs all the time is, in order for your product to go on our shelf, something has to come off. So if your product, like Grind Goods toothpaste, gets on the shelf, you have to drive customers to purchase that product off of Walmart.com, the stores. Sure. And so if that product is starting to fly off the shelves, it gets growing. And to Roger's point, you get scale and start growing with the number of stores around the country as well. So Dude Wipes started about 400 stores, and they're now across all of our market.
Sorry, I'm just reading the box of the,
and so,
the grind.
So, Roger, what do you want to do in order to help? I mean, obviously, there are parts of the country where a random Walmart shopper wanders in. How do they know about this product? What are your plans to try to promote it and increase demand?
Yeah, that's from the get. When we launched, how do I say this? I went all in on it, right, with my savings account. So I say that to say that we didn't come from big money. We don't have deep pockets. And the growth that we've seen has been very much organic, being on the shelf, and that is a good thing. But we are very much trying to do a raise right now, a funding round, and we intend to go very big on marketing and market like we absolutely should. So we're really excited about where this will go once we actually turn on that marketing switch. And Walmart has really given us the runway to do that.
Right.
Most organizations don't. So it's been very helpful in that regard.
And I suspect that when you go to VCs or other, you know, angel type or whatever round you'd be in, the existence of your product in 650 stores gives investors a bit of confidence that this might be a bet worth taking.
It does, for sure. Yeah.
So now your company is Grind Goods. What are other goods that are ticking in the back of your mind there?
Oh, in the back of our mind, this is a ways out because we're laser focused on toothpaste right now. But in the back of our mind, we're looking at deodorant and the other personal care opportunities, just different lines like body care and hair care and stuff like that. But that's a ways down the road.
Now, you've talked about other flavors, and you also mentioned that the danger in fluoride is particularly acute with respect to kids. Is the mint a kid attractive flavor? And are you thinking about stuff like bubblegum and those other ridiculous flavors that we see on the shelves now in terms of trying to attract kids?
Yes. Kids do love this one because it's not super minty. It's actually a mint coconut vanilla flavor. But that said, we did create a kid's toothpaste in the lab. It's a very fun flavor. I think kids are going to really love it.
Yeah. So backing up, so the 7 renditions that you did in the lab, you had to pay that out of pocket.
I did. Correct.
And then you got the open ticket. Now, if you get some more marketing money and you get bigger, are you allowed to go in other stores, or is there a certain number of years that you are at Walmart exclusively?
No, there's no exclusivity on the product itself. But that said, everything is based on velocity. So as long as we are trending in the right direction and I keep pushing and keep growing with sales, the numbers will come. So, for example, we were in 365 stores, and I think a testament to our ability to sell has grown us into 650. There's talks of more with more, sales. So as long as it continues to grow, we'll continue to see stores grow.
As long as you don't become that product that comes off the shelf for the next open ticket.
Correct.
And now, is it an open ticket that will come off the shelf for another open ticket?
No, not always. Okay. It's usually the product that's not doing well. And to Roger's point, you driving more sales and more customers to that product, your product would continue to grow with us too.
Good. And what is the website for Open Call, please, Mark?
It's walmart.com/opencall, all one word. And our event this year, as I said, applications close July 25th. Entrepreneurs will be notified the week of September 2nd. And then our event takes place October 7th and 8th in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Outstanding. We just spent a few minutes with Roger Gindelsberger Jr. and Mark Espinoza. Gentlemen, thank you very much.